This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station. The Property Show on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, you're tuned in to The Property Show, our weekly take on all things property related. I'm Sim Wee Boon. It's the last Friday of the month and as usual, Chris Tan of Chur Associates joined us on the line today to answer some of the questions on our monthly property legal clinic. As we all know, there's been an outbreak of a coronavirus pandemic and it has affected a lot of people, households and offices and everything. So naturally, some of the questions that have come in are in line with that. So our first question is a WhatsApp from Samantha and she's asking like, Chris, if someone is infected with COVID-19 in my condo and the condo needs to be disinfected, will it be the management that pays for it or the residents that pays for it?
Okay, so first of all, the question said in my condo. So my question is that my condo basically means by unit or the common property. So there's two different things here. So I'm not sure what Samantha is mean by my condo, right? So let's put it this way. If let's say it is in Samantha's unit, obviously, the cost of disinfection would be on Samantha, right? But if it is on the common property, which means that on the corridor, on the lift lobby, whatever that is in the common area of the entire condominium scheme, then obviously the cost of it will be then borne by the management, right? However, even if you look at the question, it just say that, you know, will it be the management or the resident have to pay for it? Actually, just so that you understand, the management fund in order to pay for all this actually come from the residents. So because the resident will pay the management fees, all right, which is for the services, maintenance, and of course the sinking fund in that sense. So even the management is utilizing either the management fee or the sinking fund is for this purpose of this disinfection if there is any COVID-19 virus found in the condominium. So I would say that very likely that, you know, even though if it's happened in the house or in the unit of Samantha unit disinfection will be on the cost of Samantha, but outside of the area would then be the cost of the paid by the management through the utilization of the sinking fund. The reason I mentioned sinking fund is because this is unusual and this is not really being provided for in the normal yearly maintenance budget for virus outbreak disinfection. So I would say that, so the answer is the management utilizing the sinking fund contributed by the residents.
But say that the management does not actually take any action. There is a case, the residents are worried and they want measures to be taken, but the management and the condominium people are not doing anything. What is the next move that the residents can make?
I think first and foremost is that, you know, obviously communicate with the, first and foremost with the management committee. There's a committee, obviously there's a chairman with all the office holder and whatnot. And obviously say that this is serious or whatever and check whether there's any order from the authority to perform this task. Because if it's an authority order, then obviously the management corp will have to do something about it, correct? Now, if there's none, in the absence of which, then obviously then communicate with the management corporation first. If they don't react to it, then there's a few things we can do. Obviously, being one of the owner of the entire scheme, then you can actually call for an EGM to get this through or launch a complaint with a COB, which is the Commission of Building, and let them intervene with a direction again to the management committee to comply on this. I think if really there's such a case, normally there would be certain instruction from probably the Ministry of Health or local authority of concern because public health is being threatened. So there would be an authority order. And when there are authority order, then obviously a non-compliance would then allow any residents or any owner to refer back to the order and make a complaint with the relevant authority.
Now we move on into our second question. This question comes from Nirendra. It's via email. Nirendra is saying that, I feel that the company that I'm working for is not doing enough to protect its employee from the outbreak. Is there any legal recourse I can pursue to pressure them to take measures like, you know, a business contingency plan or, you know, any other measures to protect the employees?
Let's put it this way, like I said, this is a pandemic, this is an outbreak, and for all intents and purposes, even we follow all the prevention and whatever that is required, in a way, there can still be a virus infection, like it or not, in that sense, because there is no standard. Like, for example, if you ask me, if I'm an employer of Nirendran, I'm the company, let's say I'm the owner. So my question to you is that, you know, which is there a standard that I can follow? That if I follow this standard, right, if anything happens, I'm not responsible. If at all you feel that the company is not doing enough to protect the employee, make a representation to the company. And you feel that if you are threatened due to the lack of concern by the company, you should make a lot more noise and communicate. And really, really, if we still disturb you, you have to take more drastic action. But let's put it this way, even if you want to say that you caught the virus at work, it is an issue of evidence. How do you prove that? And to me, a lot of time it will be too remote. And is it due to the lack of the preventive measure implemented by the company? Or is it because of the nature of the work or whatever that is? To me, you can pursue this matter in court if you want to. Or you want to pursue it with the health authority to say that, you know, or even local authority to say that there have been negligence and whatever that is. But it would be very hard to prove causation in the sense that to prove that it is due to the lack of the policy or protection offered by the company that lead to such infection.
This is a question for myself. You know, given that with this outbreak going out and the government had announced measures to restrict movements, close shops, sure, no doubt a lot of business and premises will be affected. Are there any legal considerations that people should start looking into preparing, especially say you're in a situation where, you know, within this month you were looking to sell a house or rent the house or, you know, rent a unit?
Let's put it this way. I mean, like I said, there is no actual law called the Landlord and Tenant Act in Malaysia. So what happened is all mainly on your contract, for example. Correct? So let's say if really this thing really bother you as a tenant, then make sure that, you know, you have to talk it very clearly with your landlord. Or if you are a landlord very disturbed by this, for example, you don't want a case whereby, you know, the infection or infected person who tested positive is actually end up being your tenant and therefore making your premises very questionable in terms of potential for the next renter. For example, I'm just saying, right? Then you have to make it very clear. Like I said, you have just mentioned this is a unique situation. It is not common. And therefore, in uncommon times, you have to use uncommon sense in that sense. Put in whatever you think is matter, very simple. If it is important enough, it should be in writing, correct? And it must be clear enough for us to know what would be the consequence if it's not complied with. But whether enforceable or not or whatever, at least it captured the intention of the party.
Okay, my next question is, it's come from me. It's a hypothetical situation. Let's say that I have been tested positive for COVID-19 and I'm renting a place. So my landlord finds out and my landlord decides that he or she wants to evict me, basically vacate me from the premise. Can he or she do that? Also, what can I do to protect myself?
I'm just saying very simple. You look at your tenancy agreement. I don't think there's a provision to say that if you caught a pandemic, whatever, that there's no specific provision into this area. So I would say that it's very hard for termination. As long as you are paying your rental, correct, there's no reason. You are entitled to the such thing called quiet enjoyment of the premises. So at least as far as tenancy and landlord is concerned, you have to understand possession is what we call 9-10 of the law. And if you are the tenant, you have better rights compared to the landlord.
And we'll have more of your questions after these messages, so stay with us on BFM 89.9.
The Property Show on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome back. You're tuned in to The Property Show on The Morning Run. I'm Sim Wee Boon, and we have Chris Tan here with me on the monthly property legal clinic. It takes place every last Friday of the month. Right now, we have a question from Ong. He WhatsApped this in. He's asking, does the strata title holder have the right to sell or rent out a unit, especially being S&P and the other document names remain under the original buyer, not the loan?
So, first and foremost, we have to understand what do you mean by strata title holder, and then there's such thing called remain or original buyer. I think for all intended purposes, we have to clarify that for the listener here. What happened is that because it takes a long time for the issuance of strata title, traditionally or generally in relation to strata title, so there could be a situation whereby there is a transfer of ownership happens prior to the issuance of the strata title. And eventually, when the strata title is issued, it will be issued in the name of the original proprietor, and most of the time it will be the developer. And before it can be transferred to the subsequent buyer. I suppose the question that is given before us is premised upon the whole idea of really there is plenty of sub-sale or subsequent sale, or it is a situation where a developer sold to the first purchaser sold to the second purchaser, and probably a third purchaser kind of situation, whereby the strata title only issued after the first or second purchaser, right? So in that case, very likely the strata title is in the name of the developer. And if at all we follow the track of the agreement, the strata title is supposed to be transferred into the last purchaser, whether it's the first or second one, doesn't matter. But now if you want to sell, does the developer, for example, in this instance that we put in here as the original owner, right, can, because of the non-transfer of the strata title, can the strata title holder, now we're talking about strata title owner in the sense whereby the strata title actually featured that person as the owner, can they sell? So literally the answer is no, because of the sequence of the documents, for all intents and purposes, prior to the issue of strata title have changed hand. Therefore, the developer also would have the record of the ownership changes. So it is only the last purchaser of the property, no matter how many hands you have changed, have the right to sell. So in that sense, I suppose we need to really know a little bit more the history in order to advise further.
And now we have another question from Omar. He is asking, I am selling my property and I would like to check with regards to the SPA. Will the vendor or the purchaser be paying for the fees for the SPA, assuming that the vendor and the purchaser are using different lawyers to represent them?
Okay, I think the answer is in the last part. Assumingly, the vendor and purchaser are using different lawyer to represent them. So if you appoint a lawyer to represent you, obviously you need to pay for the fees of the lawyer that you have appointed and represent you. So vendor will pay their fees, and therefore purchaser will pay their fee as well. So okay. In short, if both parties are represented, therefore they have to pay for the solicitor that represent them. So it's only fair, right? Because each of you have one lawyer. It is only a situation whereby is, you know, the party will just say that, hey, we want to hire a lawyer. And that lawyer, because we want to save costs or whatever, we are not going to hire two lawyers, so both of us are using the same lawyer. So if the buyer and the seller are using the same lawyer, then the question is that who does the lawyer represent? Because at the end of the day, the lawyer cannot say that they represent two parties. The lawyer have to represent one party. And normally in the transaction of a sales and purchase agreement of two parties, a lawyer necessarily need to represent the purchaser. So if you ask me, if again it is a purchaser's lawyer, rightfully the purchaser shall pay the fees of the lawyer and not the seller. And if the seller choose and elect for the fact that they don't want to be legally represented and leave it to the purchaser lawyer, then in the agreement will effectively state that the vendor is actually not legally represented. So in that sense, it will be reflected. So again, As long as it is clear that the lawyer represents who, then that party will have to pay for its fees. Yes.
Okay, so last question, pretty long one. This comes from Julie. She's describing her situation. I rented a room in an apartment for 6 months.
Yep.
Part of the agreement was high-speed internet because I need it for work and studies. For the 2 months, there was no internet. And when they finally installed the internet, it was not the speed that was promised.
Sure.
No compensation, so I decided to move out because I just can't stay there with no decent internet. So she told them that I will find someone else to replace and finish off the contract. And when she found someone, the person agreed to move in. But on the day that the person wanted to move in, I think the landlords asked for his passport and got angry upon seeing his nationality. And they don't want him there now, and they don't want to return Julie's deposit. Should Julie make a police report?
I think, first and foremost, we have to make it very clear. I mean, making a police report, you can, but whether the police will take action is another matter. Actually, making a police report for all intents and purposes have a few purposes. Number one, the police will only take action if this got to do with criminal offences. Alright, so if it's a civil dispute, then normally the police will not take action. Now, if it is a police report regarding to a civil dispute, what does a police report do? It actually acts as a very good evidence. It's like a statutory declaration that you're willing to stand by your own word in the police report, because otherwise you're making a false police report which is actionable again. Right? So making a police report in this context is only to record the facts, and that you're willing to, it's like a way to say I am sworn or sworn by the facts that I put forward. So I'm ready to stand by and I say that this is actually the honest truth. So making a police report doesn't warrant the police intervention for sure. Right? Now let's go back to the tenancy agreement. There's a few things here. Number one, high speed internet. Right? So if Julie has specifically mentioned that she needs high-speed internet, and it's actually stated that, you know, it is due to the fact that the premise will have high-speed internet, that Julie actually take up the tenancy and the premises. So if that's the case, to me, it is actually the landlord fault in breaching the tenancy agreement by not providing it, and therefore should naturally allow for a termination. However, like I said, tenancy really, there's no statutory law. It has to look at the contract specifically. If the provision is very clear to say that if at all there is no high-speed internet within certain time, or if it is none at all, the tenant can actually terminate at any time. So I thought the extra effort by Julie to get someone to replace her to continue the contract might not be necessary, right, in that sense. And obviously, if I'm a landlord, I'm very happy that you find someone to continue for me. But now that Julie have offered that, it make it a little bit more complicated, because it's sort of like the first part of the breach is no longer important. Now that the second part of the breach is that I say I'm going to find someone to replace, and then you will not allowed me because of this person's nationality, for example. Now, I'm saying to you is that there's such thing called freedom of contract, yes? So when you get someone to replace you in a tenancy agreement, for all intent and purposes, it is actually a fresh contract. Like I said, I have the right to rent out to anyone I like. I don't have to a reason. But in this case, obviously, the reason cited before us based on the facts provided by Julie is nationality. It could be any other reason, I don't know, correct? So, like I said, we do have a freedom to say whether I want to contract with this person. So I would say that, you know, they can pursue this matter on a civil court or whatever, but I think it's not very favorable to either party, though I won't say that anyone were particularly a good case. But if Julie have not offered this whole thing of getting a replacement tenant and go on the basis that there is no high-speed internet as promised, and therefore the termination of the tenancy agreement, Julie will be in a better position as compared to offering the replacement tenant.
Okay, very good. Yep. Very good advice. And hopefully Julie sorts out her problems. Sure. That's all the time we have for the monthly property legal clinic today. Thanks as always, Chris. Join us again next month as Chris Tan of Chur Associates helps shed some light on your legal property conundrums. Send your questions to property@bfm.my or WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. We have the 10 a.m. news bulletin coming up next, followed by Enterprise, PFM 89.9.
The Property Show on BFM 89.9, the business station. Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.